Welcome to the Art of High Performance Living. I am your host, Iron Mike Stone. We speak with best-selling authors, business leaders, CEOs, entrepreneurs, and the pros that know. Hello, everybody. This is Iron Mike Stone. I am very excited today to welcome Terry Lynn Koop. Terry is a native of California. She has studied civil engineering at the University of Pacific in Stockton. After graduation, she took a position as an environmental engineer with Mobil Oil, where she managed a portfolio of projects in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Stints as a construction project manager and auditing followed before she became the environmental and safety supervisor for Mobil Chemical Plastics Manufacturing. After working on projects at the corporate legal division, Terry decided to leave the company and attend law school. She graduated from the University of Tulsa College of Law in 1998 and worked with Legal Aid in Tulsa. She became involved with her husband's antique toy and collectible business, selling online and in trade shows. Her family moved to Kansas in 2001, and she took a job as a public defender in the criminal court. The family business also flourished as the company developed and reintroduced some classic 1960 toys to the market. After the loss of her husband, Terry semi-retired from law to run the collectibles business full-time and pursue a career in writing. Her first novel, the legal thriller titled Devil's Deal, won the prestigious 2013 Claymore Award for Best New Novel. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be here today.
That's great. Boy, I got to tell you, that was a long introduction because there's a lot about you. You're not just, you don't just have one story. You've got a whole lot. So I'm very anxious to dig into this. Let's go back.
Go ahead. Well, I just have a tendency to reinvent myself.
Yeah, well, that's a neat tendency. Let's go back. Now, you grew up in California, is that right?
Yes, I did.
What part of California?
The Sacramento Valley. We moved around a lot. My dad was in construction.
Okay. Beautiful area out there. So you grew up there, and that's where you actually went to college. And you, growing up, did you know what you wanted to be? You eventually became an engineer. Was that something you aspired to, or did you just kind of fall into being an engineer?
I was really good in science and math, and I attended community college for a couple of years. And then a recruiter came out from University of the Pacific, which has a really strong engineering program, and convinced me to apply, and I was able to get some scholarship funding and was off to the races.
Well, that's neat. Now, being an engineer, and then you went on and got hired by Mobil Oil, okay, that's a pretty lofty achievement that I think anybody would be very proud of, and many great careers are made of that. How long did you stay an engineer?
I was with them for about 6 years. I took a chance. They were on campus interviewing summer interns, and I just went up and flat out asked if they'd consider interviewing for a permanent graduation position, and I kind of got the hem and haw, and then they said, well, we have a slot, and I was hired on, and spent the last semester of school with a job offer in the bank already, and then I moved around the country with them. They did a lot of downsizing of their engineering divisions across the board before the merger with Exxon. So I was there for about 6 years before I decided to go to law school.
Well, I want to just dig into that just a little bit further, because there's a lot of listeners, and it's kind of one of the passions of the work I'm doing and the things I'm studying, of people who are you know, a lot of people get a job and spend a long time in a career and never really have the courage to leave that career. So I want to kind of just go back. You're an engineer, probably making pretty good money, okay, with a Fortune, I don't know what they were at the time, probably a Fortune 10 company. Fortune 5, exactly. One of the biggest, most respected companies in the country, if not the world. You've got a great position with them, probably a great career track. One of the few women, because let's face it, we know corporate America is, staffed up with a lot of men, and the, women opportunities aren't always there. So you're there. How the heck did you get the guts and the courage to walk away from that?
Well, a few things. The rumors of the merger were on the air. Nobody was saying anything specifically, but if you were willing to look at the wall, the writing was there. And I just decided that it was time to do something different. I'd gotten to a position in my job where I like to go in, I like to go into a new office, and I like to change everything. I like to reorganize it, re-energize it. And then once it's done, I start getting a little bit bored with it. If mobile should have just sent me around to different offices to reorganize them. But by that time, I'd been involved in a couple of big environmental projects that involved legal inside and outside legal counsel and dealing with city governments, and I was fascinated by it. And I also, for example, real estate people within the company would come to me and they'd ask me to read real estate contracts about the environmental clauses in them. And I just became very, very interested in it and really just made the decision. It's like, I need to do something different, and started looking at law school. And University of Tulsa is very, very integrated with natural resources and the oil and gas industry. So they were all over me. And I made the break. It was time to do something different and never looked back.
Wow. Well, I definitely congratulate you on that. That took a lot of courage because, of course, you left your salary behind. And not only that, you had to pay for law school, which isn't exactly cheap, I understand.
Not even close. I've got the student loans to prove it.
Yeah. So, that's one of those things that, over at high performance, we study and we look at is, the easy path, the comfort zone would have been, whether you were going to stay with that company, if they were going to downsize, you probably would have had plenty of easy job offers. You could have just stayed into a life of grinding out the engineer without going to law school. You took a big risk. You took the big leap. And that's pretty neat. So you go to you go to law school and you graduate, and then what happens?
Well, it was again, timing is everything, and mine has not always been perfect, I will have to admit. It was also a time when law firms were downsizing, and I just looked around, and I went to work for Legal Aid, the nonprofit, completely different, flipped 180 degrees from Mobile Oil. It is my second year in law school. I also worked for the prosecutor's office as an intern, making $5 an hour, doing arraignment court and preliminary hearings, and I got interested in it. Legal Aid they actually paid fairly well for a pretty easy schedule, and what I did is I interviewed clients that were coming in, evaluated their cases, and determined whether or not they'd be assigned out to the attorneys. Because some people just had a simple question. You could say, oh, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's the phone number. Give them a call. They'll help you out. Others were considerably more complicated, and it was very, very interesting. Got me involved in kind of social justice law.
Neat. So then after Legal Aid, you graduated law school and got hired with the public defenders?
Well, no, in between there, I met my husband, or the man who was going to become my husband. I was always a collector of toys and science fiction memorabilia, Star Trek, that type of thing. And in law school, I started selling on eBay to supplement my income.
Nice.
I'd go out and I'd hit the flea markets and hit the garage sales and sell on eBay. And I actually met my husband at a collectible toy show. Well, I met him and we got married. And I also started expanding the toy business while I was working at Legal Aid.
Okay.
So two jobs, essentially. We were getting the family business going while I was also working as a lawyer. And we just needed more space. We needed warehouse space, that type of thing. Noah had family in Kansas, so we moved north of the border to Fort Scott, Kansas, which was just a little town that we always liked. And we were able to buy property from an estate very inexpensively that was big enough for our business.
Okay, pretty neat. Now, tell me a little bit about that business at that time. You needed like warehouse space for like what or a store? Tell me about how that all worked, the collectible business.
Well, we did have a storefront at one point, but most of our business was online. And yes, it's just you just need brute force space, you know, for boxes upon boxes of stock. You know, we'd go to auctions and fill the van up. And you needed to have space to sort it, lay it out, take photos, pack it, you know, just like any other retail business, except we were online.
Right.
And Noah had his own stock that he brought with him, and so did I. So when we merged our households, it was pretty chaotic, but it was a lot of fun. And again, at that time, property values had really gone up in Tulsa, and we just couldn't afford the kind of space that we needed, so we looked north into Kansas and found a great spot.
Yep. So pretty neat. So you guys moved to Kansas, and then that's when you took the job in the public defenders.
Yes.
Yep.
I lucked into it. I was in the right place at the right time, and what it was is the county paid me a certain amount every month. And I took whatever clients they gave me. It was just, you know, go clean out your inbox every morning and see what new cases you'd been assigned to, and then handle them as the defense attorney through the court system. I also worked with abused and neglected children cases, cases of people who'd been put in the state hospital for mental illness, that type of thing. Pretty much, it was you had no idea. Excuse me, you had no idea what was going to come across the plate every morning, and you just had to be ready to hit it.
Wow. Yep. And so you're doing that and kind of on the side working with your husband in the collectible business.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And how long did that go on? How long were you a lawyer in that position?
I was there for about 13 years. And I also handled felonies. We were paid separately by the state of Kansas to do that. So was involved in some really, really interesting cases, and the cases with the kids, sometimes those would go on for 4 or 5 years. So we were doing really well. And one cool thing with the action figure, the toy business, is in about 2005, we after a brutal court battle, acquired the trademarks to some classic 1960 toys, the Johnny West action figures, and we invested in that, and we reintroduced them to a new generation.
Wow.
Yes, and that was a company that I'm actually still running. It's called Circle X Ranch. That's a name from the toy line.
Okay. Wow.
So,
What kind of products you have, like play figures and action figures, or what, tell me about that?
They're 12-inch tall, molded plastic, posable cowboys.
Wow.
They have all sorts of clothes, and the clothes are made out of like a soft vinyl. It's one of those, if I showed you a Johnny West, you'd probably go, I know what that is. Because they were competitors with G.I. Joe.
Okay.
And
you either
played soldier or played cowboy. And
it was
quite successful. There's some online collecting communities, and I sell it by mail order and at toy shows. I still do. Around then is when my husband became ill.
And sorry
he passed on in 2014, and I had another decision to make. I made the decision. I semi-retired out of practicing law, and I worked on maintaining and perpetuating the family business. First, I enjoyed it, and B, it was for Noah to keep, you know, kind of cement his
legacy.
Legacy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's fascinating. Now, let me just dig a little bit into Johnny West and these 12-inch things. So you, like, manufacture these things?
Yes. We actually had the molds made, manufactured them. We had to import them. We did our best to find a U.S.-based manufacturer, but at that time, they're just...
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of U.S.-based manufacturers are so busy that they just weren't even interested in us. They're just like, you know, come back and talk to us in like three years.
Yeah.
So we did import them.
So you guys, you're this nice couple working, you know, running the selling on eBay, and you're working in the public defender's office, and you decide to become these entrepreneurs manufacturing this classic character. I mean, what's up with that? Where'd you get the courage and the guts? How did you know what to do?
It was something Noah really, really wanted. And he did a lot of the research, found manufacturers. We also talked to some like-minded people who were doing some similar work with other classic toys. And they kind of hooked us up, gave us some leads on manufacturers. And then, right in the middle of it all, we got a cease and desist letter.
Ugh.
Yeah, and I wasn't about to cease or desist, so I took him to court. And it was
a
bruising federal court trademark battle, but we ultimately came to an agreement and went full speed ahead with manufacturing. And it was an interesting experience. Just a funny story. We had an order coming in, and it comes in by ship, and then it's brought across the country by rail. I had to go up and pick it up in Kansas City. So I'm up there. I drive up there with my little station wagon, and I'm surrounded by all these semi-trucks, you know, and rail cars. And I have my manifest, and I go in, and she's like, well, how many pieces do you have? Well, I said, 8. Well, she's like, you know what, you have like 8 rail cars? No, I have 8 boxes. They had like stored them in the bathroom.
Love it.
So,
I love it.
So they brought them out on a forklift, and I loaded them in the back of my station wagon and headed on home and got back to work.
There it is. Wow. That's, you know, I'm going to just kind of take time out there and reflect on that, because part of our audience and what we reach out to is entrepreneurs. And you know, I can only imagine that time. You know, you're working as a lawyer. You guys are running a nice, simple business, and you get involved in this, you know, pretty scary, far-reaching goal of taking over this classic character, producing, finding a producer overseas, getting it shipped, getting a lawsuit in the middle of it. You know, a lot of times on the path as entrepreneurs or really anything in life, we run into these roadblocks that we didn't know we were going to have. And you're getting all this thrown at you, and you just kept marching on and going through it, huh?
And that's exactly what you do. I mean, everything, you used the correct word, scary. You know, getting the financing, committing, you know, sending off, hitting the button on an international financial transfer to someone you've only spoken to via email. But then it was also realized on the other side when I'm putting those boxes in the, you know, boxes in my station wagon and knowing that this was our business.
Yep. Well, I congratulate you on that. That's a huge accomplishment to be able to go through that process and get there. That's tremendous.
We cemented our little corner of in the genre of the toy collecting industry. We cemented our little corner of history.
Yep. Pretty cool. Pretty neat. Now, let's jump over again. Okay. You were an engineer. You were a lawyer. You're an entrepreneur working the Johnny West, working through all that. Where does writing come from? When that hit you?
I think everybody grows up or goes through college. It's like, I'm going to write a book. You know, sort of thing, or you write your short stories and everything. It was mainly, though, when I hit Kansas. I don't know, it just seemed like everything kind of fell together in our life. We had, you know, the big rattle-trap house that everybody has when you live in the Midwest that we were fixing up, and we had the business, and things were going well, and it just, I came on, I joined an online workshop, a writer's workshop, and started writing short stories. And then it's just a chance meeting with a literary agent at a writer's conference gave me the germ of the idea for the novel and the character who's my main character. I've always been lucky through my entire life. Whenever I've needed it, a teacher or a mentor has popped up.
Yeah, well, I got to jump I got to just start right there, because number one, I love your humility that you've always been lucky, but you said a couple things, okay? I mean, it wasn't like you were sitting on your couch at home and somebody came knocking on the door and said, you know, I'll be your mentor or helper. First, you said you took action and you joined a online writer's workshop.
Mm-hmm.
That was your first step into the scary world of unknown world to you at the time of becoming an author and a writer. And then you ended up at a writer's conference. So you took yet another action and you went out and you sought to hang around with the people that were doing what you wanted to do. And that's exactly, you know, as I study a lot of business training and entrepreneur training and how to get from where we are to where we want to be, those are the kind of steps that we have to take. You don't, when you're going into a new area, okay, if you were hanging out with lawyers and doing all the things lawyers do, you may never became a writer, but you started taking the action steps and hanging out with writers and you became a writer.
And absolutely. And most communities I've found, whether it's the legal community or the writing community, they're extremely welcoming. And as you said, I did take the actions. And when I say lucky, it was more like I've always had somebody pop up and say, no, wait, you're not quite the right direction here. You need to turn 5 degrees to the left and go in that direction. And I've always been very humble and appreciated that, because it meant somebody saw something.
Yep. Well, listen, I respect that, and I think you do exactly the right thing. And it's, you know, whether anybody wants to go in any direction, that's one of the big things you need to do. You need to start associating with the people that are doing what you want to do. And that's exactly what you did. Let me take this leap and go right into the, as you became a writer, your first book was Devil's Deal, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And right out of the gate, you win the Claymore Award for Best New Novel?
Yes, it's given at a writer's conference every year called Killer Nashville, which is a thriller, crime, oriented. And I'll say I beat out probably, I think it was 250 entries. And
wow.
When it was announced because I'd gotten notice that I was a finalist. And I attended the conference, and if you're a finalist, you go to the banquet, because that's when they're going to announce the winner. And, you know, they announce the second runner-up, and it's like, oh, okay, it's not me. Then they announce the first runner-up, and it's like, oh, okay, it's not me. And then they announce me. And it
what
was a very,
it
was
actually,
oh, it was sublime. I mean, it was very, very much sublime. And what was funny is one of the people that I thanked is a thriller writer named John Gilstrap, who gave me my very first professional level critique on something I'd been working on, and he told me it sucked.
Right.
And I still tell that story, and he always laughs when I tell it, because what he did is the complete thing he said is, he said, we both know you're talented and we both know this sucks. And it did. Well, it was my first novel. You know, it was my first novel. It was the one that it was the phrase is, it's my trunker. It went in the trunk, never to be seen again.
Yep. Well, thank God he didn't tell you it was great. You might never became, you know, as good as you did.
Precisely.
You went and upped your game, I guess, to get where you knew you had to go.
Well, that's something that I've always a old saying that I've always ascribed to is, always play tennis with somebody who can beat you.
Yeah, I like it.
That's the way you improve. Because what you
find
as you go along is it takes increasingly better people to beat you.
Yep. Good advice. We're going to we're getting a little bit short on time, but tell me a little bit about your, you know, I know being a lawyer, and I've listened to your radio show, which I think was left out of your intro. You also run a wonderful radio show. The what's the name of that?
It's called the Blue Plate Special. It's part of the Authors on the Air network. And I do kind of a multi-genre, whatever attracts me, anything from crime writers to comic book writers. And it's on Friday night, 9 o'clock Eastern time on this network. And I thoroughly enjoy it.
Yep. Well, you do a terrific show. I've listened to many of the episodes. And one of the things I've drawn from it is where you get your inspiration and where a lot of the people you talk to, I notice, are lawyers or retired lawyers. So the field of law certainly gives you a lot of fodder for topics for writing, right?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. It's drama in the round. You know, it's extremely human. It's always emotional. Even a business lawsuit comes down to the emotions. And that's where the story comes from.
Yep. Yep. The old saying, truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, is probably some of the things that come out of there you could never even imagine that you've ran into, huh?
Not even close. Not even close. Yep. I wrote a story, Authors on the Air put out an anthology of crime victim stories for charity. And the story that I wrote in there called Legal Aid, just about everything in that story has happened to me at one time or another. And it's been very, very well received because I was able to get the truth to ring through.
Yep. Yep. I love it. Tell the listeners where we can learn more about you, get your books. Where's the best place to go? Can we buy your book, Deal?
The great evil empire, Amazon, is the best place to find my books. You can either put my name in, Terry Lynn Coop, it's COOP, just like the chicken, and that will bring up the entire list of the books, including the anthologies that I'm part of.
Okay, beautiful. And the way I like to close my show is I like to just kind of go back and ask advice on living and succeeding. The one nugget that I'm going to just recall everybody on here is your comment on playing tennis with better tennis players to improve your game. Excellent advice to our listeners. Excellent advice. Don't be hanging around with people that are at your level or below your level. Attach yourself to people who have a higher game. You're gonna grow right with them. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us on closing?
Well, if you do that, what you're going to find after a while is people want to start playing tennis with you because they know that you can beat them.
There you go. There you go. Well, listen, Terry Lynn Coop, I've enjoyed playing tennis with you today. You're better than me, and I'm gonna work on my serve. And what else do you do in tennis? A slam, I guess. And
absolutely.
With that, we're gonna let you go. Thank you very, very much. And that's it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Art of High Performance Living. As your gift, I'll be happy to send you my best-selling book, Ignite Your Life. Co-authored by Brian Tracy and dozens of other leading entrepreneurs, sign up at imhighperformance.com or send me an email, mike@imhighperformance.
This copyrighted podcast is presented to you by Iron Mike Stone and the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.